And tonight on Coast to Coast, we will talk about Stargates, Ancient Mysteries. Now, for the entire program, Gary Evans joins us. I'll tell you about Gary in just a moment. And then later on, Robert Schock comes back to Coast AM as we talk more about the pyramids and these ancient mysteries. So get ready for one heck of a journey on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Gary Evans with us. A cross between Indiana Jones and the Crocodile Hunter, Gary Evans has been investigating Earth mysteries for more than 20 years, from studying sound acoustics inside the Great Pyramid to exploring the Moray, an ancient site high up in the Andes Mountains of Peru. His work has taken him to some of the world's most fascinating and mysterious places. Gary is now working on a television show treatment called Places of Power, Unlocking the Mysteries of the Planet's Most Sacred Sites. And he's got an interesting background as well. Now, he's going to be with us for the entire program. Then later on, Robert Schock joins us to add his thoughts on these ancient mysteries. But, Gary, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Hi, George, and it's good to be on the show.
Interesting background for you, because as we get into how you got interested in ancient mysteries, you did one heck of a transition, because you have placed a lot of guests on my program.
That's right. Yeah, it's been a pleasure dealing with your producers over the years, and I've actually lost count of the amount of different clients and contacts that I've had on the show over the years.
And so how'd you go from being this incredible PR agent to investigating ancient mysteries, or was this something you were always interested in?
Well, it started off in my late teens after I left college. And I started to just see what was available in the local library. This was before the internet had hit here in England. And once I started delving into some of these subjects, I realized that this picture painted of history and the planet, where it was everything was kind of known and we knew most of the answers. Well, that isn't the case at all when you start looking into a lot of these subjects. There's our best case theory at the time for a lot of these big questions. And so I suddenly sort of developed this insatiable appetite for knowledge about the planet, history, ancient cultures. I remember one time I went to the local library, and I went up to the front of the library with a huge stack of books. And they said, Gary, you can only get 10 books out at a time. And I was very disappointed. So I thought, oh, well, there's an easy solution to that. So I went along to the next city, went to their library, got another 10 books out from there, and went home with my 20 books. And then just worked through them. And I repeated that for quite a few years until the internet started to kick in and I had sort of more tools at my disposal.
The internet truly is a remarkable piece of information for us to go search and study. It really has changed everything, hasn't it, Gary?
It has. And I couldn't do what I do, connecting people around the world. I mean, we have people joining us on tours from 16 to 18 different countries at a time. So it's helped connect like-minded people, but also people collaborating on projects. And so in a way, you could say that time's speeding up because a lot more's happening at a faster pace now.
Oh, it sure does. I mean, I can't believe we're going into March at the end of this week. It's going way too fast, Gary. When you talk about ancient mysteries, and I've always been fascinated by them too, because I think something has happened on this planet a long, long time ago. I think many strange things have happened to good old planet Earth. We'll talk about a lot of them with you and Robert Schock a little bit later when he joins us next hour. But in your opinion, based on the areas you've researched, how old do you think civilizations really are? Because I think they're much older, much older than what modern science is telling us today.
Yes. Well, I'm kind of the Graham Hancock, Robert Schock school of thought, where we're pushing things back comfortably to the end of the last ice age. And that seems to be the evidence coming to light. I mean, there is a lot of speculation that we go back even further in terms of kind of, you could say, advanced consciousness or civilization. But I'm trying to keep my research into the realms where we've got some kind of an evidence, something tangible that we can share with people that start looking into these subjects. And rather than just like really out there speculation, because I think we do need to at least try to follow some of the evidence. And it's exciting times with a lot of these ancient sites that seem to be going back to the end of the last ice age or even earlier now.
Gary, of all these sites, is there one that just mystifies you the most?
Well, that's it's always a tricky subject to put me on just one. But I, if I had to pick just one, it would be the Great Pyramid, the last remaining ancient wonder on the planet, because I've been in there, so I saw of over 20 times, many times just with one or two people. We've also done various private visits, taking lots of different people inside, and some of the experiences we've had have just been incredible. Things that I thought I would only see on the TV in a sci-fi film, those kind of experiences. And so it really can be a life-changing, quite literally, location.
When you look at the Great Pyramids from inside and outside, do you, I guess the first question you ask yourself is, okay, how did they do this? Mm-hmm. As you try to just figure out how we would do it, even in modern times, I'm not so sure we could.
It wouldn't be financially viable, I think, because I think the analogy that's normally used is that we put a huge amount of money and effort into like building a hydroelectric dam because we know that there's going to be some huge benefit in terms of power, but also obviously financial revenue incoming. So when we start to look at the Great Pyramid and some of these other pyramids, and I spent a lot of time on location with Chris Dunn and Stephen Meller, yeah. And so we do think that they were obtaining some kind of a benefit as a result of all of their efforts. But we in our modern age haven't quite pieced the puzzle together to understand what that benefit coming out of the system is. So at the moment, in terms of the finances, we probably wouldn't be able to justify it. If we even had the precision to build something like the Grand Gallery inside, which I am doubtful we could build that to last 5,000 or plus years, because that's completely over-engineered for what we're told the purpose of the structure is.
Gary, of course, the Zahi Hawass theory is that a lot of Egyptians made these pyramids. And let's assume for a moment that he's right,
mm-hmm.
that these Egyptians made the pyramids, maybe 1,000 of them or 50,000 of them. I don't know. How long, if he's right, how long do you think it took him to make them?
How long did it take them to build the Great Pyramid?
Yeah.
Well, I think the normal math works out at about 20 years because they try to fit it into the picture of history that we've been given. From what I've seen on location, they definitely seem to have had an easier way of moving these stones than we're aware of, because one of the very early reports that I always go back to was that they placed this sort of sheet of metal underneath the block. And then they hit the block with a metal rod or a rod, and the block lifted and sort of levitated along the ground and then dropped. And that was going back to sort of early Greek reports. So that's definitely one side of it that we're missing. And they were certainly using the Nile and getting ships up very close to the base of a lot of these structures. But then, it's moving the stones up, and as the pyramids get gradually higher, it becomes more and more difficult in theory.
Sure. And some of these blocks, I mean, if they traveled along the Nile to get where they did at Giza, wouldn't the ship have sunk? I mean, those things are heavy, those blocks.
Well, we can see in the quarries, I mean, the biggest, the unfinished obelisk, as it's called, they've estimated weighs up to sort of 1,200 tons. So obviously, somebody thought that they were capable of moving that. They did have some incredible barges, and you can kind of see where the Nile would have come in. But once you've got it off of the Nile, that's where the real problems start. And this is where we can start to discuss this kind of sound and vibration, because the obelisks, and there's some fallen ones at Karnak Temple. I was standing at the base of one of these fallen obelisks, and Stephen Meller just hits the top, which I guess is about 20 to 25 feet away, and you can hear it rings like a bell all the way down this huge granite piece. So it's very, very finely tuned, just like an instrument. And that's quite amazing for something of that size.
Well, and if that's the case, they had to have used that frequency for something. They put it to use, I'm sure, didn't they?
Definitely. And one of the things that we can go into perhaps a bit later is I'm working under the theory that perhaps that there was this, you could say, spiritually advanced, and by spiritual, I mean spirituality in terms of the ancient spirituality rather than kind of modern interpretations, because it has got a bit of a bad reputation these days in some circles. But if we look at the sort of Eastern mysticism and the techniques that have survived for thousands and thousands of years, that perhaps if you had an advanced group of people that had developed themselves, that by working as a group and rather than individuals, that perhaps they could tap into some of these kind of paranormal forces.
Let's assume for a moment then we had this advanced group of humans, not extraterrestrials, but just mere humans who possess this incredible knowledge. What happened to the knowledge? Why did it just simply go? It disappeared.
Well, this is where we start to look at the cataclysms, which Robert Schock has discussed a lot in his recent work.
Yeah.
If you did have, let's say for argument's sake, a small group of advanced people living somewhere like the Amazon, and the wrong kind of cataclysm comes along, and they're the only people on the planet at the time, and they all get wiped out, then nobody else has got access to that knowledge, and it goes with them. And that seems to have been what we think has happened at the end of the last ice age, where we had these pockets of high civilization, people with mathematics and geometry and a lot of the sciences that we now recognize. And the ice age has either ended very abruptly and they're along the coasts, which is where we assume a lot of people were, as we still like that today. The water levels rose, and a lot of these people have been killed off, with just a few survivors in high points in the mountains, perhaps. But they were just, say, for example, they were just fishermen or something, not people working in the sciences. So our civilization is going to get knocked back, equivalent of thousands and thousands of years. And perhaps that's what's been happening on this planet. We've had these little pockets of advanced knowledge, and there does seem to have been that in Egypt at one point. And some cataclysm has come along, or changes in the climate that have affected the people.
Now, when you were out there in Egypt, you've been there 20 times plus, anything mystical happened to you?
On quite a few occasions. And one of the big areas that I've been looking into is the effects of acoustics at ancient sites. And there's some science that we can look at. So we've got some legs for this line of research. But basically what happens in a nutshell, if we look at the work from UCLA, the Mindfulness Research Center, they've done some studies with an EEG, and between 90 and 130 hertz, and really the magic number seems to be 110 hertz, what happens is that the hemispheres of the brain kind of sync up. So if we're in this kind of rational state of mind, it's moving us more into the intuitive space. And this is where we start to see the sort of right-sided dominance. And at some of these ancient sites, we're able to tap into this right-sided dominance and this sort of intuitive space. And in my opinion, this is when these kind of mystical experiences have started to happen for our group.
What do you think they use the pyramids for, Gary?
The majority of the pyramids, the Great Pyramid, the Red Pyramid, and the Maidum Pyramid in Fayum, all have these chambers inside them that have got acoustic properties. So what we can say today, if we go inside the pyramids and we access these acoustic properties, we can have these mystical experiences, either as individuals or even more enjoyably so as groups. I'd be happy to discuss some of our experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like it's much, much bigger than that. So that's where I tend to look at the work of Chris Dunn, and we've discussed this on some of our tours, that perhaps there was generating some kind of a field that was coming off of these pyramids, because the immense size of them seems to suggest that they were designing something more than just for people to enter. I think what we can do now is get a taste of what they were doing back in the day, because it's very effective even now. But originally, they were probably generating these huge resonance fields or something else connected with water.
Well, Christopher Dunn, of course, believes that the pyramids are power plants.
Mm-hmm.
If they were using acoustics and sound, it obviously wasn't to move the blocks, because they had already moved the blocks, unless this was in tandem with it. But what do you think the purpose of the pyramids might have been then? What with the sound, for example, was it a weapon? Was it, as some have said, was a earthquake stabilizer in the region? What do you think they were doing?
There's definitely some interesting lines of inquiry that have gone across the sort of tectonic plate stabilization. One of the best theories that I heard, which ties in, John Anthony West called them spiritual granaries, and I work very closely with Walter Cruthendon on his CPAC conference and other things.
Sure, good people.
And
these must have been the guests you set up, because they're all great guests.
He's one of my favorite authors. I get on very well with Walter. We spend a lot of time discussing cycles of time, why we've got this advanced knowledge and it seems to have died out. And, of course, with his philosophy on the Yuga cycles, these mysteries start to make a little bit more sense. But if we're talking about pyramids and spiritual granaries and them generating these kind of resonance fields, which do affect our bodies, that's where we're getting to with the science. And if there was a cycle of time where in this kind of descending cycle, where there's these other factors affecting human consciousness, then perhaps that they were trying to prop up human consciousness by elevating these fields of resonance that they were living inside. And that would seem to make more sense with the size of the pyramids, and also the pyramid fields that stretch for a long way along the Nile. I mean, it's a huge area that they could have been affecting with machines or buildings of that size.
It's safe to assume, though, that the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids by it, that they were built for some specific reason. I don't think they were building it to honor gods or to make it just match Orion's belt. They had a purpose, don't you think?
Definitely, yes. They're completely over-engineered just for tombs. When you walk up inside the Great Pyramid and take people inside there, the amount of effort and just the difficulties that they've caused themselves. I mean, there was a number of different ways if you wanted a chamber up where the King's Chamber is to do that. But having the Grand Gallery, this 20-foot-tall corridor, this inclined slope that has a corbelled ceiling that steps inside, well, if it's about 100 feet long. And when you're sitting in the King's Chamber, there's a metal ladder at the bottom of the Grand Gallery, so it's about 120 feet away, and you can hear someone's foot touch that ladder. It's that sensitive to sound, incredibly sensitive. And normally what I try and do is I speak to the guests after we've had these experiences inside, and I say to them, well, could you put into words your experience for me? Because it's obviously, if it's just Gary sharing, it's not as effective as other people's words. So I'd like to just read you out a quote of somebody's experience from one of our tours, if I can.
Let's do that when we come back, Gary. We're going to hit this break right now, and we'll get right into that. This is fascinating. I mean, the pyramids specifically have always interested me, but, you know, you have looked at stargates, too, in Peru, and I want to get into that as well. Gary Evans, our guest, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating discussion with Gary Evans. Next hour, Robert Schock joins us, too, as we talk more about ancient mysteries right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Gary Evans with us, of course, as we're talking about ancient mysteries. You were going to read something for us, Gary. Go ahead.
Yeah, so this is a quote from Kissinger after spending 2 hours inside the Great Pyramid last year. And I think this kind of illustrates exactly how deep these experiences can be. So she says, like never experienced before, we had 2 hours private time in the Great Pyramid. I knew from a previous visit which is the right place to lay my back on the floor. The universe was flowing and glowing through me while I was toning, creating sound as the group, together with the voices of our magnificent group. I was no one and I was everyone. I was nothing and I was everything. Toning in such a large group produced extreme and excellent healing of all of our bodies. I think she means emotional kind of healing. And the resonance in the King's Chamber was absolutely indescribable and divine. My sensibility arose to a very high extent and still lasts. And that was her writing to me several weeks after this experience.
You know, I'm picturing 500,000 Egyptians at night outside the pyramid, and all of a sudden this unbelievable sound keeps coming and emitting from the pyramids. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, it just goes through all of these people and kind of tunes up their consciousness and everything else. Might that have been used for something like that?
I'm there with you. If we had the time machine, I'd happily go back and give it a test run, George.
Yeah, exactly.
But there does seem to be some early reports that the pyramids were creating this kind of humming sound. That has come down to us. I mean, effectively, over the thousands of years, particularly when I think the casing stones and things have come off of many of them, so they have been decommissioned to an extent. So when we are going inside them now, that's why I think we're able to have these experiences, because we're getting a taste of what was happening. Because is it just a coincidence that we can go into, and it's not just the Great Pyramid, say the Red Pyramid is very powerful, and also the Meidum Pyramid. Many of these pyramids we can go inside today, if we get the sound resonance, and particularly as a group, by working together, we can have these altered states of consciousness. And I've had many deep epiphanies. I mean, you basically, you're raising your consciousness on what I would say up the consciousness ladder. And then suddenly you're going to have this huge epiphany, which is a completely different perspective on something. Or perhaps you've been wondering about your life's path, if you want a new career, perhaps it's love, whatever it might be that you're kind of seeking the answer to at the time. This whole new perspective, which might be the opposite to what you currently thought, comes into your head, and this kind, you kind of get this huge sense of all of the background attached to it and why things are the way they are. So it's really quite profound experiences that we can have.
And you know, Gary, building it was one project. Creating it and coming up with a concept and the idea, that was unbelievable.
Yes, and it demonstrates, I mean, one of these epiphanies, which is probably a good example. We'd had one of these group experiences, and I was leaving Luxor Temple. And as I was walking out, I was starting to think about how I could sort of describe the experience we'd just had, because I was thinking it was over. And all of a sudden, I had this huge picture come into my mind's eye, and it was a kind of a sense of the people that were in Egypt thousands and thousands of years ago. I didn't get an exact date, but I got the impression it was earlier than we credited them with. But these people didn't perceive the universe and the physical world in the same way that we do today, because that's one of our challenges, getting back into the ancient mindset, getting over our modern cultural lens and filters that we've got so used to. And it isn't easy. That's one of the lines of research I'm trying to work on. So as I saw it, the people that were there in ancient Egypt understood that they were consciousness of the universe manifested onto the material world, and that they'd come here for various reasons, because you can have different experiences in a physical environment to one out in the universe as awareness, you could say, and that their fascination with the heavens and building these structures to mirror the heavens was because they were this universal consciousness that had manifested onto the physical plane. And in the same way that they were here, they wanted to represent the heavens on Earth. And it was this kind of combination that was part of their whole scientific view of the world. But different to how we work out knowledge, we have the scientific process, this sort of step-by-step working out of solution. They had an understanding of the natural laws that governed the planet, particularly, possibly the whole of the universe. And once you know how the physical world interacts, why the animals interact the way they do, the natural forces, if you have that kind of depth of knowledge, then you have a much greater control over the physical world around you. And I believe that is the approach that they were using when they were designing and building.
Gary, let's talk a little bit about what is called the Devil's Den in England. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. That's another one of the spots you looked at.
Yeah, and your webmaster, Lex, has very kindly put up some photographs on the Coast website.
Yes.
So that I was hoping that would probably help people picture these sites a bit easier. And in fact, number one on the website is the Devil's Den. And what I would first of all say about the Devil's Den was I found a connection with acoustics. This is in England. It's about 45 minutes drive north of Stonehenge. This incredible landscape near Avebury and Silbury Hill, a very special place. And here there is a dolmen structure, which is effectively a kind of, you've got two upright megalithic crystalline sandstone blocks with a capstone across the top, which is probably weighing around 15 tons plus. And as I was sitting inside there with another one of your guests who was on recently, Maria Wheatley,
yeah.
I looked at the capstone and realized that there was this head-shaped hole right dead center in the capstone. And because I'm looking at these sites from an acoustics perspective, the first thought that came into my mind was, I wonder what would happen if I stuck my head inside that hole and created some of these vowel sounds where we get the resonance in the structures going. And I had a hooded top on at the time, and that's exactly what I did. I put my hood up and stuck my head inside this this huge hole, and it's effectively like a helmet. It comes, your head goes inside, and the block comes up sort of below your chin. And when you sort of chant or intone inside it, you do vibrate this huge crystalline stone around your head, and it's only about an inch or so around clearance. And it's one of the places I like to take people, and I say, before we enter the site, just check in, see how you feel now, and then we do that when we leave. And there's normally a big difference in how you feel on the entrance and the exit from this site, particularly when you're interacting in this way. And interacting with ancient sites, what I call power places, which we'll touch on later, finding the sites that are still active today, taking people to them, looking at my experiences, looking at other people's experiences. That's my, I would say, my main area of research. Where are these places that really touch us? Which are the ones that have survived thousands of years and are still active or partly active? And so it's been an exciting journey.
Well, and a journey nonetheless that has gotten you some incredible answers to, I think, many of the questions you've been trying to get answered, Gary. Robert Schock, of course, same kind of curiosity as you. Let's move over to Peru for a moment and tell us what you did over there.
Well, the connection between the Devil's Den and the doorway of Amarumuru near Lake Titicaca. Well, the doorway of Amarumuru has been called a stargate by a lot of people. I mean, people like William Henry and people have discussed that site. And what the Devil's Den reminded me of when I had this head-shaped hole was the TV show Stargate, where they would put their heads near a wall and this kind of arm came out and wrapped around their heads, and they would have this huge download of information. So that was my kind of first impression after experiencing this, because that is literally what can happen there and other ancient sites. You do get this download, or if you want to call it an epiphany or clear insights, but they can be very, very powerful. So the link to the doorway of Amarumuru was the Stargate, which has been called by many. And I was keen to visit there and make my own impressions, because that's quite a strong term to call any ancient site. And I visited there with Brian Forster. We had a private tour with him for just under 3 weeks back in 2011. And that doorway, which has been called a Stargate, is one of the most powerful places that I've ever visited. There's a few comparable places in Egypt, but it is not a disappointing place to visit at all. And as an example, there was a group of us who visited, and I have this approach to ancient sites where I'm very mindful of what I do. I tend to meditate at them, and you can also just by connecting to the earth, removing our shoes and grounding, which there's a lot of science behind, it does sort of slow our heart rate down a bit and reduces blood pressure. So there's some things, techniques that I use to tune in, as I call it. And when I did that at the doorway of a Marimuru, the energy that was in this environment was really just sort of flooding into my body. And there was four of us there at the time, two people taking photographs, and they entered the site and left the site in the same kind of state of consciousness, I would say. But the two of us, myself and a Kundalini yoga teacher who spent time meditating and tuning in, when we left the site, we were speaking 1,000 miles an hour because we had this huge amount of energy and we were sort of really buzzing. And we went back, needless to say, a few times because it was such a powerful location. And Jerry Wills, there's some interesting information from him. He talks about acoustics at the doorway of a Marimuru, that there's these three special tones that you use, and that is possibly what activates this doorway and could turn it into a stargate. I haven't had the pleasure of sampling that one yet.
That would be amazing, almost like time traveling, Gary, isn't it?
From his experiences, and there's some things on his website, it's exactly what it sounds like. There are some local reports that people have sort of manifested in front of this doorway. Jerry actually reports dematerializing through it, and his wife, Kathy, was very concerned because he'd completely disappeared and then reemerged a few hours later after going on a trip out into the universe. And after what I felt there and these experiences that I've been having at other ancient sites, as outrageous as perhaps that sounds to some of your listeners, I wouldn't discredit it any longer, because from my experiences at some of these places, reality is actually stranger than fiction.
Do you think that these sound vibrations can literally change matter, change its shape, change what it is?
The sound vibrations and acoustics are definitely, you could say, changing the consistency of our bodies in terms of the vibrational nature of them. And I believe that is what's happening with some of these acoustic frequencies. And there's two main sciences that are involved in this area. One of them, which is psychoacoustics, and there's some interesting research being done at Stanford. And that's the scientific study of sound perception and the branch of science studying the psychological and physiological responses associated with sound. So that's one that I've been brushing up on. And then there's the archaeoacoustics, which is the study of acoustics at archaeological sites. And there's just been an amazing conference that finished in Malta, and they've had some huge, interesting discussions over there. So in terms of what's going on in the body, when you're using some of these sound frequencies, it literally feels like you've taken a weight off of your shoulders. Sometimes I've stepped out of the Great Pyramid and felt like I could almost float off of the ground. And the best thing about this whole area of research is if we just look at the photos on the COSA website, I'll direct people to.
Great
in photo number 6, I'm pictured with this large gong, which you beat with a kind of a mallet, and it gradually creates this sound frequency. And this is what I would encourage your listeners, if they're interested in these subjects, to try and find a gong bath, which are generally run at meditation centers and yoga studios, and they're quite widely available, particularly easily in California and Sedona and places. And this will give anybody an exposure to almost what it's like to be inside the Great Pyramid when we use this sound vibration. You're bathed in sound, and after an hour or so of being in these sound frequencies, you just have this kind of euphoria, a glowing of the skin like you've just had an amazing bath or a jacuzzi. It creates this kind of feeling, and definitely feeling much, much happier. And I think it's helping us on an emotional level to let go of things that perhaps we're holding on to that no longer serve us.
The individual or individuals who put all this together worldwide during this era, they must have been geniuses. They had to have been, don't you think?
From our perspective, They are, yeah, definitely still geniuses, because they were viewing the world in an entirely different way. And you're right, it was a worldwide phenomena, which is what we're starting to see. I mean, there's this site in Peru, Moray, which we touched upon earlier, and the acoustics there are just incredible. So we've got acoustic sites in Peru, we've got them in Egypt, so I'm starting to see signs of them in England and Stonehenge. There's been a lot of scientific reports coming out where that they've been finding this kind of sound connection. And I was in Ireland with James Swagger, and we were doing some sort of drumming in some of these underground chambers. New Grange has amazing acoustics. So there's a pattern across the planet, and the pattern seems to be that our ancestors realized that sound frequency has an effect on our physical bodies and our awareness on the planet, and that they perhaps were using it for answers for their civilization, and perhaps helping them to try and avoid some of these catastrophes that no doubt have come along.
Why did we lose the technology or the knowledge?
That's where the work of Walter Crassenden comes in. Because if we're talking about cycles of time, which does seem to make more sense, Walter's work looks at this 24,000-year cycle where we have these higher ages of wisdom, you could say, or awareness, consciousness on the planet. And then we have these lower ages where we're more aware of the physical world. If we can't touch it, something doesn't exist. I mean, we start to forget a lot of these finer and more subtle forces of the planet, which is what we can touch upon later, perhaps with Robert Schoch. So in terms of cycles of time, when we look at the planet, we've got these amazing pyramids in Egypt, other ancient sites, 2,500 BC backwards. And in our history books, we have the kind of the Roman era, the Dark Age, we have the Renaissance, the rebirth of this perennial philosophy, this ancient wisdom which has survived through the Dark Age, and then we have us. So that isn't a linear progression of history. We have got advancements, we have a Dark Age, and now we have the rebirth and us coming out the other side. And that, if we look at our history books, matches a cycle of some kind of consciousness or knowledge on this planet much better than primitive to smart old us in the modern age.
I assume you believe Atlantis was real.
Well, I actually have a website, AtlantisEvidence.com, which we've got linked up on your own site. If we're going to talk about Atlantis in terms of an advanced race of people that we've forgotten about, and it could be argued that's us if we're into reincarnation, I'm definitely on board. And there were a global, appears, seafaring, at the very least, culture that could certainly travel around the planet.
Let's talk about that, Gary, and we're going to take this break, and we're going to bring Robert Schoch in with us to talk about some of these catastrophes that hit this planet a long time ago.